Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, away from the guilty.
I'm aware that there's still some who would question or even justify the offense of 9/11. But let us be clear. These are not opinions to be debated. These are facts to be dealt with.
This is John McGuire, and you are listening to episode 95 of Always Record. This week, joining us is Matt Pulver of BlueScience.org.
Arsenal just astonishing.
Next, we'll learn words that begin with letter
I'll be
D.
The big bad body rocking Bombay, the boulevard bully back. Better bring a bomb to the battlefield, buddy. Black beats bringing bottoms that boom. Basically, build barriers, bewilder buffoons.
Listen now to words that begin with letter C.
Crazy character, constantly creating concoctions. Catalyst of cannibalistic rhymes, conqueror. Correctly connecting craniums, crumble down. Consistent capacity.
Next, we'll hear words that start with letter D.
Done did that, done did this, diddle don. Domination, don't dignify diction. Doing it deep down, dialect during doomsday. Duck, devastate during the duration.
Listen to our song for all E.
Extraterrestrial, electrical, effortless. Eons of energy, everyone affected. Efficiently, epitomize excellent, extravagant, elevate where the essence is.
F is the letter with which these words
begin. Blackalicious got funk for the future, filling up things finally. Fabulous, furious, fatness, follow me. Makers fall frequently, fact, verbal felon fired up. Federally, foundation, fake, all of this whack shit.
Carefully again, two words with sounds for letter G.
So Matt, since the last time we've had you on, I heard that you went to a screening of 2001 and that you actually handed David Bowman, Keir DeLay, a copy of your False Flag Odyssey printed out.
Oh, no, that wasn't me.
Oh, somebody else handed it to him.
Oh, okay, cool.
Oh, you never heard about this?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, Alan, I told me at one point, he actually got handed a copy of your deal.
Awesome.
I thought that was pretty cool.
So it's making the rounds? That's
yeah.
Pretty funny.
Well, he thought it was interesting. It was told to him what it was about. I wish I could remember who gave it to him, but yeah. No, I like how that shit works. You know, you put stuff out there and you don't know where it's gonna end up. It's kind of a cool thing to put something together like that and then release it and then know that it's going places, so
Yeah.
You know, I really like the theory, probably up until like the halfway point, because I have a hard time putting a conspiratorial spin on the latter half of the movie, which seems much more to do with like transcendent themes that go well beyond any kind of false flag thing.
Seeing
the first half of the movie under what Matt is saying kind of helped me see it in a new light. And I think a lot of it does revolve around that. But then there is something extra, I think, that comes in the second half of the movie that is like well beyond geopolitics and like manipulation.
I think the point is that we wouldn't put it past the guy, and that things can be multifaceted as well, where there's double, triple meanings, you know. It's like a Pink Floyd song. You can take every lyric so many different ways. I think you could take what's being communicated different ways as well. I felt that you had a pretty strong argument. I wouldn't say it's absolute, but from talking to you before, I don't gather that you'd say that either. If you're gonna say it, you might as well run with it, you know, like, well.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying, John, about the transcendence idea, I wouldn't put that mutually exclusive to the whole false flag, because on a deeper sense, seeing through the deceptions of life is itself a form of transcendence. And so I think he was getting, you might say, metaphysical. I mean, in some sense, when he's on his deathbed, it's, you know, there's the idea that the monolith there represents death. And, you know, death itself, as it's put in our culture, may be a deception as well. It's really not the end. It's not this towering black presence that stands before you. You know, it's actually a gateway into something else. And, you know, these ideas, I think, resonate with what we see in real life. Because for many people, you know, the 2001 false flag, namely 9/11 itself, was a gateway into seeing behind a veil. So, I think these ideas are all connected.
That's a good point. Yeah. No, and I don't disagree with you at all. I didn't mean to say that there was no connection between the two or anything. I'm just saying in terms of emphasis, you know, and obviously like the beginning of the movie is implied throughout the rest. But at the same time, again, it's just, I was just saying emphasis more so than black and white, this or that. But okay. Yeah, points well taken.
Okay. I mean, there are a couple points, I guess, on a more tangible sense where the ending scenes do connect with the other ones that are maybe all just worth mentioning briefly. When he's, when he's in the Renaissance room, and there's the reflection in the helmet of the two camera crew moving their arms. At the same time, there's a faint, high-pitched noise in the background, and that's reminiscent of the scene on the moon where they encounter that high-pitched sound, which itself, the article is proposing that that's a feedback. That's an audio feedback loop to, you might say, as an analogy to the visual feedback loop of Kubrick, you know, being paid by, you know, the movie studio to make this movie, but it's actually about making a movie because, you know, they're filming this whole thing. So, and Kubrick himself is filming this happening. And there's, you know, there's some classic, what some people might call mistakes, but where Kubrick himself is actually showing up in the reflection on the helmet with it on the moon scene. And that's kind of showing, you know, his involvement possibly with this. And so in that high-pitched sound, I think, plus the reflection of the camera crew, it just seems like a connection that this is being made at the end. And it's also along with a thesis that the camera crew are the ones in hibernation that then get awakened at the end in order to make this film, which we see as Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. Debate that some or not, but...
Well, you focus on one part where, okay, there's like Kubrick in certain scenes, and he does, and I want to draw an analogy to The Shining, where I think either the buttons or something flips on the spacesuit. Okay, so there's like a flip in the symmetry.
Right.
And the same thing happens in The Shining where, Jesus, I'm forgetting his name. What's the kid's name?
Danny.
Danny, right. Danny is on the carpet, and he's in that hexagonal lattice. Right.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Right. And it you can interpret that carpet geometry in so many ways. I do like the idea of them being platforms, like the overhead view of the NASA shuttle platform field. It looks just like that, which is really, really cool.
Yeah.
But on another level, I see it as, you know, almost like a breaking of symmetry in space-time almost, because you can model space-time in a similar way. And all of a sudden, you have this flip. Everything is the same, but it's not. It's like we've preserved the symmetry, but it's the complete opposite of what it was. And now we've kind of like transitioned into a new space. And in the same way, I guess at that point, you could argue that the movie kind of flips a little bit, because I think that's before he enters the room and stuff starts going really bad. But even in the background of that scene, like the chair is a lattice work. It's a grid. So it's almost like that carpet almost creeps up onto the chair itself. And while it's not hexagonal, it's creating a permutation of itself on the chair. So it's almost like, I don't know, I see that as a space-time analogy, but I don't think he had any of that in mind. That's just kind of a subconscious thing, I think, that no one can escape from, that no matter what kind of story you're telling, these things are going to creep into it. And if like the fundamental reality is the mind, consciousness, everything around us, space-time, whatever you want to refer to it as, okay, it becomes embodied in those scenes. And so anyway, I wanted to know what your interpretation of the symmetry flip was and like what that meant in 2001 for you.
I think that's going with the space, the whole space. Like this is part of the reason why I think it was named a space odyssey, because there's this concept of two-dimensional space and three-dimensional space. So when like film itself is two-dimensional. Like a physical film reel is two-dimensional. And so the writer of a script, the writer of a movie, you know, writes the dialogues and, you know, what the character does and says. When they're a character in the movie, they're two-dimensional. You can pick up the film, physical film, and flip it back and forth. And I believe this is what he was proposing. And it, just to integrate this in, I mean, because there's so many other film motifs, like the space station, the rotating space station is shaped like a rotating film reel. And the whole scene where they're playing the Blue Danube in the beginning, and then at the very end, it's like the film reel, the pan, the shot that the camera takes through the center is kind of like the film reel going off of the metal reel holder, like when a film ends. Other motifs, like the whole monolith on the moon in that dugout area, is that whole thing is shaped like a movie theater. And there's even like a bright camera that, a bright light that goes on in the background, which would be like the movie projector. And there's a handful of other, and, you know, of course, the monolith being shaped like the movie screen. And when Haywood Floyd gives his speech, it's like he's standing in front of these white screens. So there's a number of things to suggest that the idea of the symbols from a movie are kind of interwoven with the movie itself. And this idea of the two-dimensional characters on a film reel, I'm proposing, is part of this. So, for instance, Frank Poole is a character in the movie, is this two-dimensional character that, and essentially this, you could say that the script is being written by Hal and his controllers. Like that chess game is an example, because he kind of, when Hal tricks him into resigning, and there's that whole, I could get into that in detail if you want, but he basically tricks Frank to thinking that certain moves are forced, whereas in fact they're not, and gets Frank to resign. So that's one example of this idea of writing the script for someone else. And so in the very first shots of when we look into the discovery, Frank is being flipped. I mean, the whole, you know, there's three out of the four scenes are flipped, cuts are flipped. And when he's walking around the, that, not the synchrotron, but the, that's using the centrifugal force. But yeah, it's like he's walking around that. So, sorry, getting back to the idea. So that, to answer your question, that this is what that means. So right before Frank dies, right before he's murdered, there's a scene of him being flipped again. And it's just showing how people can be controlled when you write the script for them. And I think, you know, the broader picture to this is, and is coming back to the false flag thing, is that you can, like, for instance, 2001, a lot of people were tricked into supporting a foreign war. I mean, this is another example of how someone's script can be written for them, right? If you're then just a two-dimensional character within a film, if you're buying into this false flag story that someone else is writing for you. And the whole space odyssey that when David Bowman, when he awakens out of this script, there's some examples of that when he's writing, when he's drawing the pictures of the hibernation tanks, the most intricate three-dimensional drawing that he makes. For one, it happens to be one in which it shows the correct orientation so that he can't be flipped. But at the same time, when Hal asks him what he's drawing, that's the one picture he doesn't show.
He flips past one. It.
Yeah, he flips past it, and it just shows him all these other childlike two-dimensional drawings, which is, you know, the idea that he's not showing Hal his true, like, intelligence. He's not showing them that he really knows what's going on here. He's playing the part like he's a character within the film, but he really does know what is going on. And so the whole space odyssey for David is really realizing that he is a character in this movie. And I would say the whole Stargate sequence, it's analogous to him leaving the surface of the screen and moving in three-dimensional space towards the projector. And when, you know, if you can imagine standing in front of a movie screen looking at the projector, you're going to see these lights coming out at you. Maybe he's somewhat like the Stargate journey and moving to the source, so to speak.
You know, something that really gets me with 2001 is that I can relate it probably to The Holy Mountain more than I can relate it to almost any other film. The way that at the end of the Holy Mountain when Jodorowsky flips the table and says it's all Maya and you're in a movie and you're backing up and then you see the set, you see the cameras. You know, John Lennon made a statement about 2001 saying that he believed it should be shown every day in a cathedral. Right. And he felt so strongly about people being able to see 2001 who can't afford it that he actually paid for an incredible amount of people to see it for free. You know about that?
I heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just he felt it was like the most important film ever made, according to him, 2001. But then he financed The Holy Mountain when they ran out of funding. That's in the audio commentary of Fondo and Liz and not in the audio commentary of The Holy Mountain, which is kind of weird. But John Lennon was actually the secret producer of The Holy Mountain. It's just that parallel feels kind of uncanny to me that they're both seem to be communicating the exact same point and the way of ascent up the Holy Mountain, which is symbolic of Meru, is very similar to the ascent that happens with the Tree of Life in 2001, where you're ascending the tree in the same way that you're ascending the mountain, and both share the symbolism. Just worth pointing out, the Defy Hollywood anagram for Dr. Haywood Floyd is really interesting, that Marilyn Manson made an album, Hollywood, which goes in sync with the Holy Mountain. And, you know, Jodorowsky officiated Marilyn Manson's wedding and made the statement that that album was the most important thing in his entire life.
Oh, wow.
Speaking to it. And so this Defy Hollywood business, actually, like, as soon as I heard that, I just went like, click, 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 you know, I was like, wow, that's really something.
Wow.
Okay. So we can probably transition back into it or something if you don't have any other questions on it. But Matt, you've been like, David, I think you'd find this particularly interesting that Matt's been working with Fourier transforms and he's been showing how those apply to subquantum kinetics, which is like, I was telling you right before we got on the call, it's a different way of modeling microphysics. So instead of just particles following traditional Newtonian trajectories and crashing around, we have what are like reaction diffusion systems, and they're more similar to like wave systems that interfere and diffract and construct and destruct one another. The same way that human vision works through Fourier transforms, and the same way that our audio recording works. And he's been working on this, and it's very close to this Bohmian. It's so Bohmian, it's crazy. And I see so many connections between it. But it like really shows like how, if that's what's going on at all levels of reality, then life itself is this movement. Okay. And then I like to see how synchronicity fits into that. But I thought maybe, you know, we talked about this on one of our Blue Science dialogues, but maybe Matt would like to just like bring it up a little bit, because I think it's interesting and I'm sure we could go in a lot of different directions with it, or no directions, but I thought it was worth talking about.
Yeah. I don't know if any specific questions or any area you'd like me to go into.
Well, I guess, what is it illuminating for you? What is it helping to accomplish? What are you modeling with it? What is it showing?
Okay. Well, the Fourier transforms, that came about from a purely technical motivation. And I'll get more into that, what that is in a moment, but.
And real quick, you have talk about that coincidence you had at that birthday party. Cause I think that's such like a crazy synchronicity that it's like, it almost like is so obvious that something wanted you to discover it. So keep going.
Yeah. So it was back in 2010 that I first started learning the mathematics of Paul LaViolette's framework called subquantum kinetics that he's used. I mean, he's been researching this since the late 70s. He actually conceived of it being, I guess you could say, even an alternative to string theory. It's really a unified field theory. It answers even just basic philosophical questions like, what is a fundamental particle? And, you know, very briefly, these are stable patterns basically within various etheric substances that react with one another. And it's a very, I guess, elegant framework in that you're dealing with very simple things. Like, okay, so the universe fundamentally, according to subquantum kinetics, is just a collection of ethers. Like there's various types of etheric substances, which you can think of like a gas or like a liquid that just kind of permeates time and space. So these substances are very, there's no structure to it. It only does two things. It diffuses in the sense that if these are clumped in a certain place, then they tend to just spread out, this process called diffusion, and they react with one another so that at the same point, at a single point in space, two different types of etherons may transform into one, or they might transform into two other types of etherons. But that's it. There's no gravity, there's no mass, there's no spin charge or any of these concepts. This is the whole system, basically. And so what he's shown is that with certain types of reactions, you can get stable patterns that develop. And if they're localized, you would call them a soliton. And this is what we would otherwise identify as like a proton or an electron or some other fundamental particle, which then has these other familiar properties such as charge and gravity that are epiphenomenal to this more basic framework. And they can interact with one another and bond and even display things like the strong nuclear force versus the weaker Coulomb charge attraction repulsion. So I was completely intrigued by this framework because he's used it to prove a number of other things like superwaves and a lot of other astrophysical phenomena. But he's been wanting to model this on the computer, but hasn't really had the resources to do that. And that was kind of my background. So I took this up and spent a number of months on it and was finally able to confirm what he had kind of seen in his mind intuitively. But I was able to confirm this mathematically and was, did this on a computer. And we ended up publishing it in a mainstream journal, the International Journal of General Systems, back in finally got published in 2013. So this was done in just one dimension, and we tried modeling it two dimensions and three dimensions, but it just, the amount of resources required to do that was just exponentially more. And we later found out that other people doing the same kind of work had access to supercomputers in order to do this. So it was, just reading through various papers looking for other mathematical techniques on how to do this. So if we can't just do it straight with computational power, maybe there's a clever way to do it using mathematics and algorithms. And so I was looking at something called spectral methods, which involve Fourier transforms. And I happened to be at my niece's 4 or 5 year old birthday party in Pasadena here, where the same city as Caltech.
Are you living in Pasadena?
I grew up in this area, yeah.
Huh. Interesting. I'm sorry, my immediate thought is Jack Parsons, but yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Go
ahead. Absolutely. Yeah, when you're walking through downtown Pasadena, there's just this huge building that just says, just this Parsons that just kind of overtowers everything. But yeah, I know, I mean, his whole occult background and all that, yeah, it'd be interesting. But I just started this random conversation with a guy that my sister introduced me to. And, I just asked, what are you studying? And I was doing something with computation. So I'm just thinking in the off chance, because my mind is just completely filled with this problem that I was working on. So I come to find out that he is actually working on modeling reaction diffusion systems, and that he's using spectral methods. And he's basically just confirmed what I was looking to do, but it was going to take a fair amount of time investment to go down this path. But so I was looking for some kind of confirmation this would actually work out. So, and he said, okay, yeah, if you're trying to go into three dimensions, use periodic boundary conditions and Fourier transforms with some other details. And so it was just completely that just seemed completely synchronistic. So I started working on that, and that eventually did pan out. But for the sake of this conversation, one interesting aspect to this, what is a Fourier transform? This is pervasive. Like, for example, MP3 files are a Fourier transform of the way that audio CDs hold data. An audio CD holds data as basically amplitude in time. So it's just a track of various amplitudes of a sound signal. In contrast, an MP3 file holds frequency data. So it takes like a small fraction of a second and stores it in terms of its frequency. And this is the first step on how MP3 files are able to achieve such high compression, because it uses what's called psychoacoustics, in that the human, we actually perceive, like, so our inner ear actually performs a Fourier transform. Like when I was studying quantum mechanics, my professor said, nature knows Fourier transforms. So like for instance, the shape of our ear, the inner ear is shaped like a spiral, and there is a bunch of small hairs on the inner side of the, along the spiral. So that when we hear a certain frequency, there's going to be a certain resonance within this spiral cavity, but it's depending on the frequency. It's going to vibrate certain hairs in a certain position more than others. And so, you know, when you play different notes on a piano, you're going to stimulate different hairs, and that's connected to nerves, which then go into our brain. So we more directly perceive frequencies anyway than amplitudes. And so like if certain frequencies are very close to one another, we can't differentiate them. And so this is how, so MP3 files then will then drop that information and thereby achieving greater compression. And that's one example of psychoacoustics, for instance. But yeah, the point being that, you know, that this is basically what Fourier transform is with music. And, but with visual stuff, it's a hologram. So if we take a Fourier transform of either a 2D or 3D image and make it into a hologram, we're actually performing a Fourier transform there. So I just thought this was, I guess, very interesting that this computational technique of modeling reality is more efficient as a hologram, you know, and oftentimes, you know, that the mathematical structure or like the way that something that physical reality is represented mathematically can give a hint as to its more truer structure of things. And, you know, there's these ideas about, at least in the New Age community, about, you know, the reality being a hologram. Well, it seems to be reflected in the actual, like, it's actually computationally efficient to treat it that way as well. So it's the interesting point, totally. I think, that maybe you're alluding to, John.
Dig it. This reminds me a lot of, have you guys ever seen the presentation of John Holmes when he was young before the Batman shooting, where he talks about using flash in order to basically, it's hard to explain. I wouldn't do his thing justice, but he talks about how to, with 3D modeling, I guess, he would change somebody's memories to actually, you could implant a different reality so that when they look back, they see something else happening other than what actually happened. To the point where they could act, the goal being that they actually believe it. Have you ever heard of this? Have you ever seen his presentation? It's pretty ridiculous.
No, but that, it reminds me of, there's a scene from the Manchurian Candidate where they are like basically, yeah, brainwashing a whole platoon. It sounds like it's using this technique, but, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So there's just very peculiar aspects to it where he names his mentor, and there's debate on whether or not his mentor actually had ties with MK Ultra past. And so it's kind of like everything that if you're going to be suspicious about it, they give you it all. Like it's like, this is a very questionable situation. when you watch that presentation, you know, it's only like 10 minutes or something, but he gives a full kind of download of what it is that he's been working on and what their aims are and trying to achieve. And yeah, it's kind of weird.
when you say questionable, you mean like morally questionable?
That and just what happened to him and the fact that it seems like I mean, the video is available on like YouTube, but it's not something that, I mean, if our news was actual news, you'd think that this would be something that was pointed out, is just what he was doing in his schooling. And he got a grant that was enormous. He was like sponsored. They put money into his project. And so the fact that the very people who he's working for like downplayed what he was doing, he was picked, you know, handpicked to help facilitate these different projects. And the ones that he was being asked to work on were questionable in terms of like, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to implant memories into somebody that's different than the reality? Like, what is the value of this? You know? Yeah. And so maybe we see the value of that. I don't know. I can only speculate.
Yeah. Yeah. In the Manchurian candidate, it was the way they used it was that there was this politician who wrote, it was basically, you know, controlled in the brainwashing sense, but they made him, they made him a war hero. So he had, you know, was decorated by some valiant action that he did. But the way that what actually happened was that they took his platoon, so that it didn't actually happen. That was an implanted false memory. They took the whole platoon in a room and were showing this cartoon basically. And they're all hooked up to like these intravenous, drugs that they were taking while they're watching this cartoon in a small kind of makeshift movie theater. And that was the implanted memory that everyone had to say that he was a war hero, and that helped, I guess, boost his career as a politician. So that might be one application.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth pointing out that the number one thing at the top of the list for MK Ultra's objectives was not how to make a Manchurian candidate. It wasn't what one might expect. I mean, it is once you think about it, but the number one thing was, how do we cover our own tracks? And either by making the person appear insane or whatever the means, you know, like whatever we can do to not have this traced back to us. And that process seems like that would kind of be the ideal way to do that, is to actually have alternative memories. Because like when you look at Sirhan, I mean, he's been denied parole, and I forget, 4 times, something like that, because he refuses to say that he remembers any of it happening when he shot Robert Kennedy. And so it's that there's long parts of his life leading up to the event that he can't access. The last thing he remembers at the event itself was seeing a polka dot dress and it being very significant to him. And then he just blacked out. So to actually have alternative memories in there, I mean, and John Holmes' thing is very peculiar, because I mean, somebody opened the door for him to the theater that was left open. And so they don't generally do that at theaters, especially like when he got all his gear and showed up, he was just able to walk inside, not through the main entrance. And so there's every reason to assume that he had some kind of aid in that. It feels very set up. It's just, you know, I mean, a lot of these things, I feel like people have good reason to question, but this is like ridiculously good reason to question. When you look at him in the courtroom and he just looks so drugged out, but it's like, he's not even there, you know, it's like, it's weird.
Let me ask you guys something. It was earlier this year, I think it was probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. It was either at a congressional meeting or at the Senate. I think it was the House of Representatives. Anyway, everyone's just milling around and they're just waiting for something to happen. This stenographer, I think that's what she was. She's like down at the bottom of the huge, you know, podium and stadium, or yeah, the podium. And she's kind of talking to this older guy, and he's like, all of a sudden makes this gesture to her. Like, they're having a normal conversation, then he gestures. And then all of a sudden she just like stops and she like stands up. It's very robotic and strange. And she gets up and she goes up to the top of the podium and then just starts ranting. Like, no one can hear exactly what she's saying, though. Actually, what they found out was Fox News made up what she said. Well, they didn't. They cut out a part of what she said outside near the elevator and juxtaposed it over what she actually said in the house. And when she was at the podium, no one knows what she says while at the podium.
Yeah, she was talking about Freemasons. And
that was at the elevator. And then they cut that and put it over what she said at the mic. But she didn't say that at the podium. So she probably said something even more inflammatory at the podium because they fucking bum rushed her and rushed her off. And the whole time, like, the guy that made the gesture, all of a sudden, like, as soon as he makes the gesture and she gets up, he didn't even take it as weird. He gets on his phone and, like, starts texting and kind of, like, I don't know. It's just weird. I didn't know what to make of it or what was accomplished or what she said. But she was clearly yelling about, like, you know, Freemasons and stuff outside. So I assume, I don't know what there was to gain from that. I don't know if it was, like, some kind of mind control, but it was fucking weird. And I think that just kind of disappeared. I mean, no one cared to really look into it anymore because I think it was so indecipherable. But that caught my attention. And that's, I think, if anyone wants to see, like, kind of a weird example or a possibility that this could happen, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, when David mentioned the polka dot dress, that whole scene you just described, John, that also popped into my mind because it's almost like in the same way that the polka dot dress may have been used as a trigger for Sirhan Sirhan. It was like that there was a nod or a gesture, like you were saying, that was given to that woman, and that seemed to trigger her as well.
And we already know that, like, post-traumatic stress and other kinds of things, there's always trigger items or trigger contacts that send them into an entirely different brain space, right? So if that's engineerable, I mean, if we can actually do that to people's minds, and I wouldn't put it beyond materialistic neuroscience to explore these subjects extremely in depth to the point where they want to try to use it to manipulate people. But so it wouldn't, like, blow my mind, because, like, there's a lot we don't know about consciousness, but I mean, there's enough we know where we can kind of, like, through brute force and kind of some trickery, because we can kind of manipulate people to do weird stuff. And that seems to be, like, it might be one of them.
Yeah.
But who knows?
It reminds me of David Bohm and what you're saying about the script and basically your life being scripted. I mean, it's just another level to that. The whole thing seems to have to do with mind control. And that's the meaning of the Predator at the beginning of 2001, where I watched that movie so many fucking times. And until I read Your False Flag Odyssey, I never put together the significance of the fact that once they kill, they're all able to, they're all huddled before that. Like, they don't want to leave their fucking cave. And then they're able to, they realize how to use tools in order to kill. And then all of a sudden they're all hanging out. And it's dusk, right? And there's no more, you know, they're able to chill. But then when you look at Hal's eye and the way that he takes on the same role as the leopard at the beginning, it's like it seems pretty direct, where he's basically the technology has become the predator, and we're being watched, right? Surveyed by the predator. And then they're having to maneuver around. And so them conquering Hal, David Bowman shutting down Hal, is very similar to them getting rid of this threat so that they can move beyond. And it's showing that there is a link between, like, evolutionary survival going to the next phase of evolution is intimately tied with defeating the predator in order to get beyond. Mm. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, the eyes are the controllers, right? I mean, that's, like, in essence what we're talking about, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. And so the machine is an extension of the controllers almost. So we have, like, almost like a technocratic soft fascism, like almost like a slip and slide into that. Philip Dick wrote about that a lot too, but it almost seems like that's part of the vague illusion as well. And that there's still, like, an intimate tie between technology and imposition of will or manipulation. And while technology serves us in a lot of ways, at the same time, it's like, I mean, look at all the problems it creates without proper consideration of its biases and what have you. Totally. So I think he has some interesting things to say about artificial intelligence and how that ties into control and whatnot, and also obviously evolution and what have you. But it can mean all these things at once, and that's what we usually arrive at, I think, is that in the final conclusion on things.
Right.
Whether subconsciously or consciously.
Totally. Well, Kubrick was literally obsessed with Pinocchio and the meanings of Pinocchio. And so when, you know, basically taking what should be, what is looked at as something that's soulless and giving it a soul. And so Hal is like the highest ambition to take something that's an inanimate object and give it a soul, but it's not generally a good idea because it turns into something destructive, which also reminds me of Apollo as the destroyer. So when order reaches a certain point, it ceases to be a positive thing. Order starts out positive, but then when it reaches a certain crescendo, it turns on the subject and becomes a destructive force. And so it you mentioning Danny walking down the hallway with his Apollo sweater towards room 237 can't help but take on another significance in that way for me, at least. I mean, I look at The Shining, I see Jack as Dionysian with his need for a drink, you know, and basically moving away from order, and Danny is actually representing the push for that order, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, no, definitely.
So, speaking of The Shining, Rob Egger, he recently reposted some videos on this idea that makes a connection between people and furniture within The Shining, which seems kind of strange, but
so literal people are like they allude to people, or they are meant to represent people? Because I've seen the interpretation that, again, it's like it has genocidal undertones, and that, say, the pile of suitcases might represent, you know, the pile of suitcases of all the Jewish people that they confiscated before they put into the camps or something. So is that what you mean, or even more literal?
Yeah, it's along those lines. But so, like, a couple of high points on that analogy. When O'Grady, I think that the
Grady.
Okay, he's the manager, right?
Well, he's the caretaker, but Jack has always been the caretaker.
Okay, right. Okay, so I'm thinking of
You're thinking of Ullman?
I think Ullman. The white guy with the fluffy hair, that the manager that.
Yeah, who he has the interview with.
Yeah. Right. Oh, okay, so that's Grady.
The Jack Kennedy lookalike?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That's Grady?
No, Grady is the man who meets him in the gold room and then brings him into the bathroom.
He's the waiter. Okay. He's the waiter, right, that killed his family as well.
Yeah. Okay, so Ullman is the manager then?
Yeah, you could say that, yeah.
Okay. Right, so when Ullman is telling Jack about the previous caretaker that chopped up his kids and stacked them neatly in a pile. I mean, it sounds like he's talking about furniture. And when Wendy, near the end, when she's seeing the blood, or at least in her mind, or physically, I don't know, I guess that's an interpretation, when she's having that vision of the blood coming out of the elevators, when she's actually on the bottom floor, uh-huh, behind her is a stack of chairs. And then also, of course, when Danny sees the vision of the two girls axed, there's an overturned chair there. And there's a lot of movement, like subtle movement of furniture. And like there's that one scene with when Jack is at the typewriter, there's, you know, deliberate discontinuities of a chair behind him appearing and reappearing.
Yes.
And then I'll explain why I'm mentioning this, but when in the beginning of the movie, when Jack is being shown around by Ullman, you see all these men moving furniture around. It's like, why are they moving furniture?
Good question.
So there's this, like, I think, I mean, my own speculation on the interpretation is that, like, you might say the elite see, it's almost like people become furniture, like the people that are non-elite are just furniture. And it's kind of portrayed by Ullman. Like, he says goodbye to the guests that are coming and going, but he completely ignores everyone, like all the workers, as if they are furniture. And maybe this, you know, this has something to do with the, you know, the disregard of people in general by the elites, you know, in terms of eugenics and all this other stuff. But I guess that's kind of, you know, going into speculation. But yeah, there's some compelling points that are made in these videos.
Yeah. He actually made the point at one point, which I made the same connection before I saw it, where he was pointing out when Ullman tells Wendy that this place was home of the Jet Set before anyone knew what the Jet Set was.
Yeah.
And she asks if Kings had stayed there. And he says, all the right people.
Yeah, or all the best people.
All the best people, excuse me.
Yeah.
And that's actually the Jet Set is, so if you listen to the Beatles song, The Beautiful People, or not The Beautiful People, what is it? I mean, they say that. How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people? It's actually a reference to the Jet Set. And so was Marilyn Manson's song, The Beautiful People, was a play on the Beatles. How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people?
Oh, I didn't know that.
So yeah, we're talking about the elite, but we're talking about a specific group that, they called them the Jet Set, I guess, because they could fly anywhere they wanted to, whenever they wanted to, you know, or wherever, whenever. And so there's an interesting, correlation, happening there. That's like, he's talking about a specific group. It's not just like, oh, these are the elite. It's like the specific elite. And so, yeah, that gets kind of interesting.
Actually, it just reminded me of something when you're talking about The Shining and Kubrick. There was something I just noticed relatively recently that I looked at the birthdays of Kubrick's daughters, and there's when Ullman says, I forget the exact ages. I think he says something like, you know, the previous caretaker had two daughters aged, I don't know, was it 7 and 8? Maybe 6 and 8? I don't remember. But those exact ages were the ages of both of Kubrick's daughters at around the same, like there's a brief period of time in 1968 where that was the case, around the time when 2001 came out.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
And so, I don't know if, I mean, that can't be a coincidence, I think, because, I mean, that's something Kubrick would have obviously recognized. So, I mean, this is another, I guess, maybe in support of the point that, or the idea that Kubrick himself was, in a sense, a caretaker for the elite, and insofar as maybe the work that he possibly did on, on filming the Apollo missions. Whatnot.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to figure out, because I know that he had two daughters, right?
Yeah.
And one of his daughters got taken in by the Scientologists.
Yeah, Vivian.
Okay. So is Vivian the same one who was speaking with Alex Jones?
Yes.
Okay. That was at John F. Kennedy's, that was at Daily Plaza. She was protesting and making, you know, basically corruption in the government and feeling that John F. Kennedy was assassinated by a rogue facet of the government, I guess is the assumption.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, I thought that was really interesting. I'm like, is that the Scientology girl? But you're saying it was.
Yeah, she was the same one that played the mother in Eyes Wide Shut, and she was also the daughter of Heywood Floyd in 2001.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, weird. Okay, so, there's speaking to things moving around, and you made the statement about the chair that you felt it was intentional. There's without question, was it a jacket that was on the chair in 2001 that disappears and then reappears? But then if you listen closely at the same time in the loudspeaker, but there's a speaker saying there's a missing pink.
Was a blue cashmere sweater.
Was it a blue cashmere sweater? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a sync wink. I mean, he's letting you know that it's not a mistake by doing so. It's not even
right.
Like a debatable point after you hear that and you see that, you just see, well, that's what he's referring to. It's sitting right there. And then it disappeared and reappeared. Right.
Right.
And so, yeah, no, it's, worth mentioning. I mentioned it here before, but I find it really interesting because I'm a huge fan of Jung, which is understandable because this, our kind of focus is synchronicity here. And, you know, the red book is on Ullman's desk while he's interviewing Jack.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not just that. It's that the red book is sitting there. And then if you watch the film Poltergeist, when towards the beginning of the film, the mother and the father are laying on the bed and the father is reading a book about Reagan. And then it cuts to the son who's reading a Captain America comic. And then, if you look closely at the mother's book, she's reading the book about Jung, Man and His Symbols. And it's not just that she happens to be reading a Jung book and that Ullman happens to be reading a Jung book. It's that the television set in Poltergeist actually has the actor Ullman talking to this other guy in that same shot. So you're looking at Ullman and then she's reading Man and His Symbols. It seems, and then, you know, the spirit comes out of the TV when the TV says 237.
Well,
the other time it says 42, which is fascinating because Danny's sitting watching Summer of 42, which is, you know, very classic synchronicity of, if you take Summer of 42 and play it with Adam Hart Mother, it's a pretty flawless sync. I have it posted on Vimeo. But that seems to be a very, as far as I'm concerned, that's a total sync wink because that's one of those ones that if you watch it, it's pretty undeniable. And so I don't know. I got to wonder.
Well, just to add to that sync, I think I mentioned this to you before, David, but I'm currently in Simi Valley. But this is where they filmed Poltergeist, and it's also where they have Reagan's memorial library. And I'm actually on the hill, you might say, where I think in Poltergeist 2, where they said that they buried the bodies there.
Nice. So I had heard at one point, and I don't know if it's just, you know, like a urban legend or whatever, but that there was an earthquake in your town quite a while ago, but long after Poltergeist was filmed, where there was a crack that went down the driveway of the house and actually split the house into two where Poltergeist was filmed. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, really? I haven't heard that, no.
Yeah, it was really spooky. I don't know. I read that at one point and I was like, really now? But, yeah, you know, the weird shit that a subliminal synchrosphere is presented with Poltergeist with the football game.
Oh, it sounds vaguely familiar. I think I might have heard that, but I don't recall it.
So if you look on the children's wall in their bedroom in Poltergeist, there's actually a poster for a Super Bowl that hasn't happened yet in 1988. So it says 1988 on the poster. It's observable. Carol Ann, Heather O'Rourke, the little girl in Poltergeist, she got sick during that game. In 1988, when the Super Bowl was happening, it was actually her, it was Detroit, I think, I forget. I think it was Detroit versus Colorado. There was a whole deal with even the scores, 42 to something, I forget, but it's 42 to 10, maybe? I don't know. But it's the other two things that the television set says in Poltergeist happen to be the score of the game, but wait a minute.
So it was Lions versus Broncos?
I guess so.
Okay, so Horace and Lion?
I might not be doing this argument justice here because I'm trying to relay something I read a while ago, but it was
really,
it was really uncanny the way that it went down because it was her city that she was living in was who was playing in the game. And if you watch Poltergeist, you know, they're all huddled around watching this fucking football game. And they actually, when they find the dead parakeet, when the mother finds the dead parakeet and she goes, oh, why couldn't you have died on a school day? And then, you know, they put on a ram's helmet onto Carol Ann when she slides across the floor. And there's this whole relationship between Poltergeist and E.T. Obviously, they came from the same screenplay called Night Skies. And if you, I do an experiment where I superimpose the films over each other. And you'll notice that the boy in E.T. is actually wearing football outfit with the, what do you call it? I want to say armor. I'm terrible. The top part of the football outfit.
The jersey.
The fucking pads. He's wearing a jersey, but he's wearing the pads too. And he's wearing the upper pads, and then she's wearing the fucking helmet. He takes the pads off, she puts the helmet on, and it happens pretty much in sync. And so and it happens to be while the mom is showing the father the poltergeist, saying, "Hey, check this out." It happens to be simultaneous with Elliot showing his brother E.T. and like, "Hey, check this out." And then they both carry the same exact energetic of like, I found this thing out. Let me show it to you, you know? But the football, aspect is like really, prominent in both films simultaneously. And then for her to get sick during that game and then die on the way to the hospital is really kind of profound and creepy.
You're right. You're right in the neighborhood that they filmed that movie.
Me, yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Hey, you know what? It's not ancient Indian burial ground. It's just a...
There was someone who was psychic stayed here once, and, you know, they didn't know anything about the poltergeist thing, but he was just saying that it feels very Indian to him. And I don't know. I don't have Indian artwork up or anything, but it's just one thing.
Hey, this is... Oh, go ahead, David.
I'd be curious of what the history of that town is, if there was an Indian genocide or something
right
going on there. I mean, there's a lot of places like that where it gets kind of buried, too, where you don't always know. There's places where it's really well known that something happened here, like Pyramid Lake or something out by Burning Man, but I'd be curious to know if something like that happened there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even have to be like a burial. It could just be like an event that's left an imprint and is like facilitates those kind of experiences. I think that happens in certain cases. So like this is kind of it's not a 180, but it's, since we're just talking about apparitions and whatnot, I guess this guy built I don't know how close you guys are to where the Tate murders happened, or the Manson murders, excuse me. But a guy built a house either adjacent to, right next to, or across the street from the house that it took place in.
Filio Drive?
I guess so. And he's, for a while now, reported extreme hauntings and, like, purports to have made some kind of contact with, like, Sharon Tate. And I think there was, like, the neighbor boy or something that was killed out in the driveway. I'm forgetting exactly. He was like killed out in the driveway, and he was one of the first ones that was seen on the premises. And like, it was way up, like he was having a party, and there's nothing, no scaffolding or anything outside the window. And there's just a person gliding across the window. And it was this guy. And it was this guy, supposedly, once he saw a picture, he was able to identify him. And that's why they made these connections, because he saw the pictures later. And he's like, yeah, that's who I saw.
You know, it was one of the first things that they did. When the police came in after the murders, after Jack Nicholson cleaned up Sharon Tate's blood. No, obviously after, it was while Polanski was coming back from France. I don't know if you guys knew that. Jack Nicholson and the head of Paramount cleaned up Sharon Tate's mess.
Oh, wow.
They left pig on the door, and then obviously Trent Reznor, when he recorded the downward spiral over her death scene, you know, he ended up taking the door with him for his next studio in New Orleans that got flooded, you know, but he took the pig door. That's why if you listen to the downward spiral, it's obvious. It's about Helter Skelter, the pig theme throughout the album.
The fucking pig head, right, in the video? Oh, God, that's so fucked up.
Well, that's why. But where is I going with this? So the police brought in a psychic. One of the first things they did when they showed up on the scene, they left him alone in the space to walk around. You ever heard about this?
No, go on.
So I forget the man's name, but this is actually a fact. It's a fact that he surveyed the scene. What he has to say is like, whoa, and I don't know. But he talks about Egyptian-style orgies happening there, basically Egyptian magic taking place before the murders with Sharon Tate and other people, and that somebody who was taking part in this was actually one of the killers who came back. And he said they had a game that they were playing that was like a fucked up game show where basically people were recalling their last sexual experience, and the person who had the longest space between, like the last time that they had a sexual encounter, they actually got hung upside down and beaten. It's just really weird shit going on. But this was the claim of the psychic who they brought in, who I forget the murders that he helped solve before that, but he was actually like the police like actually respected this psychic and used him for multiple different crime scenes to come in and give his take. But
yeah, no, it wouldn't surprise me that there's some lingering after effects of all that stuff going on. And sometimes I think, you know, it's what psychics see is not always literal. There is they're engaging in a world that's somewhat symbolic. So that I think there was that probably did happen to some degree. People that tend to get trusted by the police aren't trusted for no reason. Otherwise, they're totally, you know, they don't get paid attention to. There's another woman like Nancy Weber. There's a couple other detectives, psychic detectives that are really well respected and have like a crazy success rate. And I tend to take what they say somewhat seriously, but I take it with a grain of salt because I don't think this is a perfect science or anything.
I think they said that he had an 80% success rate in the past before this happened. So
yeah, that's crazy. A skeptic would just say, well, he was just being vague and like that led to general vague generalizations that solved the case. But when you look at the cases, it's not how it works at all. Not for the ones that are like legit. They're like super specific and to the point that even when there are some generalizations made, it's like in a larger context, there's no mistaking the specific picture it's painting and like where it leads, you know, first names with like 7 of the 9 of the last name. And a skeptic's going to be like, well, they only got 7 out of 9 or, you know, or it's like slightly misarranged or something. It's like, I don't know. What the hell do you want? It's pretty damn good. And if, so
he said that there was a party. And that somebody who took he took LSD, but he took a weird concoction that was different than regular LSD, where he basically saw the devil and had a fucking freak out. And that was apparently one of the people involved in the murder, I guess, if I recall correctly. And so that was kind of weird. especially because, I mean, Sharon Tate's first film, Eye of the Devil, I like to play it with Abbey Road. Very, very strange correspondence there. The zebra rug. I think I'm kind of going over some ground that I've gone over before. I apologize to listeners who are just like, oh, we've heard this, but I find it really interesting and it's good to, you know, restate certain things. The zebra rug. She was killed on a zebra rug. You know, Abbey Road, the photo was taken ultimately, if you look at the time zones, the same day that Sharon Tate was killed, the iconic photograph of them crossing the zebra crossing. Wow. And so, yeah, it's kind of weird. And then she has a zebra theme throughout almost all of her films. You'll have the zebra pattern show up all over the place. Patrick Svek has outlined that on his blog, Blog of Caverns. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. When I was 16, me and a couple of friends, we actually climbed up to the Sharon Tate house in Hollywood Hills. I guess the reason we went was that was when Trent Reznor was recording. And so we actually got in behind the closed, like where we climbed up was actually on the inside of the security gate. So we just went right up to the back door and knocked on it. And, you know, this guy, someone we didn't recognize. It was just some relatively short guy with a buzzed head. Just kind of denied that anything was going on there. It just kind of, you know, escorted us back to the gate. But, you know, we got back home and then we looked at one of these tour cards with Trent Reznor. And there was a picture of that guy with that was on Trent Reznor's team. But,
how the hell did you get up there? Really? It was that easy?
Well, we had we had to climb up the side of a hill. So it was all these trees and I guess just, you know, people really didn't do it enough for them to put up a fence, I guess.
Dude, how close are you to the Hollywood sign?
It's 20, 30 minute drive, I guess.
Okay. Have you heard that that place is haunted too?
No.
I guess some people have walked up that you hop the fence and they climb up to the Hollywood sign. Yeah. I guess some people have done that. Yeah. And some people have come back with stories of like a really freaky woman in a white outfit that just kind of like stalks around and kind of like follows them. And one particular group had a particularly scary encounter, but I didn't know if that was had been like a well-known haunting around there or something, but I thought that was an interesting one too, just going on my little haunting trip.
Huh.
Yeah. So, but yeah, maybe you should hop the fence and climb up there and, you know, okay. Break a bunch of laws. I think that would be like a really interesting adventure. Yeah. And then you come back and tell us what happened.
Right.
Okay. It was actually San Diego that she was from, Heather O'Rourke. And so it's San Diego versus Colorado.
Okay, Chargers versus Broncos.
Right, but that's what's interesting is that, you know, the shining Colorado, you know, there's just a lot of interplay there. So, yeah, it's also the Drew Barrymore-Heather O'Rourke connection because they were very close. They were, like, best friends.
Oh.
And so, yeah, when you look at E.T. and Poltergeist, you can see that there's more connection beyond the camera, you know. I mean, that was the summer of Spielberg. So Spielberg, those films came out within a month of each other, E.T. and Poltergeist. And so, yeah, it's I mean, the implication for me, I mean, this is interesting because of our last talk, I was going off about the Kleepote in regards to 2001 and looking at the flip frames as like the flipping of the Tetragrammaton and whatnot, because you're ascending the Tetragrammaton if you're ascending the Tree of Life as you move through the planets in 2001. I mean, Poltergeist 2 is called Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, whereas that is the way that the Chetzonim are looked at, as the other side. So it's like the other side of the tree, and then you have this tree in Poltergeist that comes in through the window, you know, and the little boy is associating the lightning with the tree. And so you have the Tree of Life is the lightning flash, you know, and so you have Lucifer descends as lightning and all of this. But if you look at the E.T. transposed over Poltergeist, when the tree comes through the window, it's pretty weird that the mother in E.T. is actually watering a large plant in the house. And so the plant is overlaid with the tree. It's really fucking weird.
I wonder if there's similar connections between Jurassic Park and Schindler's List, since those came out very close to one another. It was both Spielberg movies.
Well,
it's so weird.
Schindler's List is obviously a lot longer than Jurassic Park, so I wouldn't be as quick to overlay the two. But I can appreciate the connection of the Predator for sure.
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay.
What year was that? 96 or something? I'm trying to think. When that was a long time ago. Jurassic Park. Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the, so E.T. was the number one grossing film for a long time. And then, it may have been all the way up until when Jurassic Park came out. Cause like Spielberg held the place for largest grossing films. I believe it was Jurassic Park that bumped E.T. off of the highest selling film.
You know, Matt, I forgot something until I stumbled across it. Like, I think Jeff Goldblum's character in that is a chaos scientist. I didn't actually know. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then, like, you know, now that I have an interest in chaos, I'm like, oh, and chaos theory. And there's a brief little discussion of it because it had its like heyday in like the 90s. And I actually just interviewed one of my favorite like systems theorists. I can't wait to like have that done. And I'll like send that to you as soon as it's edited. But I think you'll find it really interesting. It's just like a general discussion of systems theory and chaos and whatnot. She's conventional, but very articulate, and I don't know. I think there's a science to synchronicity in a way, and it might be highly nonlinear and beyond our grasp at this point, but I keep coming back to it because I can't help but tying the two together. And like you said with your modeling, it's like, you know, you guys are having a hard time because it's like these are nonlinear, right? So it's really hard to get solutions.
Check it out. Yo, I just won 10 grand in the Galactic Rhyme Federation Championship, so I'm laughing a bit. I feel like returning to Earth and burning some herb. I'm sick of looking at the inside of space stations. Time for Dell trying to take a vacation. My expertise in aviation. creation got us to our destination, where? The East Bay. My living quarters is completely froze solid. I thaw it out with a heat ray. Now I'm chilling in the sun, I'm pulsating jet streams, peeping out in virtual reality my wet dreams, perusing my 21st century classic comics. The fun is astronomical. I figured since I'm here, I'll renew my galactic passport, so I'm not persecuted by no galactic assholes. Schemers on the ass, yeah, with their holographic hat tricks, using magnetism to pickpocket citizens. Tourists walk around with memory apprehension glasses. They attempt to capture the past tense. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Virtual junkies, burnt out and lost, for veterans still trapped in the Holocaust. Dumb hoes with enhanced collagen. I'm calling in sick today. Big mistake. This resulted in a final paycheck and pink slip to take. Replaced by my successor, cause I missed my place. Knowing that the Rhyme Federation will miss my face. Referred to as a big disgrace. Now I'm freelance with more risk to take. Now I'm rhyming Murph, finding certified androids. Hit a convention, signing autographs for fanboys. They admire my enhanced stanzas and how I dodge manhunts and security cameras. Avoided apprehension in subatomic dimensions. And even more impressive because of what we live in, a self-contained environment. I suggest I'm just a minor threat. I see a thing of beauty flying, hey, standing by a desk, paid him my respects. I was too scared to try to step, so I deployed one of my androids for dialect. Synthesized with my voice, perfectly replicated. Ask for her name and what she married, no consideration.
Hey baby, you looking real fine. You're behind, you got three booty cheeks. That's how you eat, whoa, on this planet. But what's that mean you hit the hot spot over here, y'all? I got a few sandwiches, stuff in there we be eating. That's cool, yo. You got one eye, ain't gonna be tripping, yo. Listen, me, we go places, baby. We go far, go all the way to Mars. Go to Venus, you want to. Venus, Paris. You sound kind of different.